Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri back with us. He is a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Been with us hundreds of times, I think, over the years. He retired as head of UW-Madison's Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. And as we talk with Phil, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have for Phil about bugs? Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Larry.
You know, hornets and wasps are on the move a little bit this time of the year. I think it was you, maybe, who told me that all hornets are wasps, but not all wasps are hornets.
Yeah, and even among entomologists, it gets kind of, you can double name things, and yeah, it gets more complicated, I think, than we want to get into. But whether it's bees or wasps, the issue seems to be those things that live on their own, we call them solitary, are usually non-aggressive. Those that live in a nest where there's multiple critters, then they often get quite defensive, whether it's bees or wasps. And because these colony forms build in numbers as the season goes on, it's usually into August and September that we get the most problems.
Yeah, and wasps, I've had problems with wasps myself. I got stung about 8 times once when I opened up a bag of dirt that had, it had been half used, and I had rolled it up and I thought I had it tight, but nope. They were in there building their little colony, and when I opened the bag, I got a nasty surprise.
Yeah, you know, and the problem with wasps in particular, yellow jackets, is that their stinger is designed so they can, one can sting you multiple times.
Yes.
You know, people think about leaving stingers behind. The only critter that does that is a honeybee because their stinger is barbed and it can get caught. But these other critters, it's like a needle, and that's unfortunate because aside from being painful, getting stung more than once is more than what most people need.
Yeah. John was wondering, why are they so active this time of year?
Well, the numbers go up, and in the case of yellow jackets are by far our biggest problem. They become food scavengers, so they're looking for protein or sugar. So almost anything you eat or drink outside, and even in some cases the colognes or perfumes you have a scent that attract them. And so they're getting more desperate. You might notice, too, like fallen apples and the like, they're busy scavenging that. And if you go over those with lawnmower, they get upset. As I said, it's just the numbers in where you find them are often in close proximity of people.
Pam and Buttermutt emailed to say the garden has been invaded by a type of beetle, and they sent a photo. A couple of photos, actually. Can't identify it in an insect book there. And they're wondering, they're mainly on Pam's peas, beans, and corn, and are numerous. And
right.
And you've seen the photos.
Yeah. So it turns out they're immature stink bugs. They're not beetles. And the adult stage is going to be more of a green-colored critter. And stink bugs are an interesting group because there are some that are beneficial that eat other insects for a living, but there are a number of plant feeders. And the feeding is subtle because they're using a needle-like mouth part. So they will cause deformities in fruit when they're feeding. I'm a little surprised. Usually you see just a couple. If you see quite a few of them, that's not the norm. The little ones would probably respond to soapy water. The bigger ones, if they're numerous enough that you start to see physical damage on your vegetables, then again, it's probably worth considering going to the garden store and getting an insecticide.
Yeah. Daryl in Antigo has something away from them, the wasps, and on to monarchs, I believe. Daryl, hi.
Good morning. Yes, Larry. I've been collecting or planting milkweed for about 6 years to improve the environment. But a few years ago, I met some people that were collecting eggs and caterpillars and actually hatching the monarchs. So I started doing it, and this year I'm up to over 50. And I'm wondering, Phil, if I'm actually hurting or if I'm actually helping the population. Have I gone too far? Should I go back to just planting milkweed?
Yeah. I think you're helping. The only consideration, this has been the best monarch year I remember in the summer for a number of years. In fact, in our own household, my wife has taken over rearing them, and she's up to about 17 or 18. Most of our activity has been on butterfly weed rather than traditional milkweed. And my neighbors that have traditional milkweed are not hitting it. But as to your question, the only concerns you have when you're rearing them is when you start putting a number of them in one box to rear. If they have a virus disease that breaks out, and honestly what happens is the caterpillar becomes liquefied within a couple days. And of course, the more you pack into one area, if there's a disease there, it would accentuate it. So we're a little careful with that. We've got a couple, three containers, and we try to keep the numbers down and clean everything up really as best we can between putting a new batch in. But ultimately, I think what you're saving them from is predation and other things that would go on naturally. So I think the numbers will increase as long as I said, you take a little care to avoid the diseases.
There you go, Daryl. Thank you for calling. Susie in Scandinavia, your turn. Hi, Susie.
Good morning. My son has a new home in Oregon, Wisconsin, and he was very proud to show me his tomatoes that are planted near his patio. And as we walked out to the patio, he just gave a gasp and said, "Oh my gosh, the deer have eaten my tomatoes." So I looked at the tomatoes and I said, "Boy, that doesn't really look like deer, since they had to stand on the patio in order to eat the tomatoes." So it turns out we think what he has is tomato hornworm.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common? I've never seen them here in Scandinavia, but maybe in the Madison area, that's a thing.
They're a little bit hot and cold, and you can go through a season and not see them, but they definitely are found in Wisconsin. We get blow-ins from down south. And it's a huge caterpillar. I mean, they get to be about 3.5 inches long, about as big around as your thumb. And when they feed on the fruit, it will look like deer damage. So, yes, you can run into them. They're a little bit camouflaged. They're green, but they've got these white side stripes. So if you look carefully, you can pick them up on the plants. And one of the options, usually it's just a couple, but a couple can eat an awful lot of tomatoes. You can hand pick them. Is one thing. And one of the other things that might be going on is we were just a week too late in finding when the caterpillars were really there and they're already gone.
Yeah, that could be too. Well, do a little inspection, the close order inspection on the plants and see if you can find any of those hornworms, Susie. Thank you for calling. Chuck in Neenah, Wisconsin. On to you. Hi, Chuck.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question around mosquitoes. I live on 10 acres outside of Neenah, and the last 5 years or so, I've basically kind of had to give up my property for the month of July and some of August. And in conjunction with that, I noticed that in the valley, there are now dozens of mosquito eradication companies. And I try to avoid using insecticides. I will if I'm really forced to. And I'm wondering, is it humanly possible to just get rid of mosquitoes? And would that not be better for us than having all these companies and all these individuals dumping gallons and pounds of insecticide into our environment? There's my question.
Yeah. So, and what complicates the story, we've got over 50 kinds of mosquitoes in the state, and there's some that come out in the spring, there's some that are associated with floodwaters. The general rule is rainfall patterns influence the numbers more than anything else. Some mosquitoes will breed 50 yards from your house. Other ones are coming in from 10 miles down the road. And so the reality of eliminating mosquitoes in the state is not possible. So then you take the next step, and you know, I know these companies have taken off recently. I guess my personal philosophy, if you're going to have a wedding in your backyard and whatnot, I think it's very reasonable to have a company come in. And what they do is they put a spray down a day or two before the festivities, and for the next week, mosquitoes that are in the shrubbery and whatnot will be knocked down. It does affect some non-target insects, but it's not as widespread as you might think. But then you take the other side of it. If you have somebody coming every couple of weeks the whole summer, I mean, one of the arguments for me is that there are times of the year that there just aren't any mosquitoes there, so you're spraying for nothing. And it has been proven that if you apply products a number of times in the summer, you cause other upsets, spider mites and aphids. I mean, it really does upset the balance. And so, again, I don't think there's anything wrong with the treatments for a reason, but realizing they're very short-term. And the long-term, you know, Wisconsin traditionally has not had organized mosquito districts. These are often multi-county organizations. And one of the things they do is they go out and map. We find that about 90% of the mosquitoes come from 5% of the water. And if you know where that water is, there are some treatments, including some biological treatments, that can be done to help reduce the numbers. But it takes an awful lot of work. And as I said, if the mosquitoes are coming from 10 miles down the road, you can see why a community itself is somewhat handcuffed in trying to address it, unless you go to a county area. The argument why we have not had those is we have not had the disease problems in Wisconsin like they do in some of the states south of us with encephalitis and other things, even though, and we still get them, but not to the point that we've ever organized. And I would, you know, we've got a couple communities. I know La Crosse was playing with it for a while. Madison had a very specialized unit that were looking for the mosquitoes that could spread West Nile. So they weren't practicing total mosquito control, but they were trying to identify the sites of these somewhat urban breeding mosquitoes. And so, as I said, there are situations, but the reality is, you know, one of the things we love about the state, the lushness and the like, means we get a lot of water. If you got a lot of water, you get mosquitoes.
Yeah. And they'll breed in a very small area.
Yeah. You know, so the ones that we get concerned about, we talk about bird baths and other containers of water in your backyard, honestly, are not the most important nuisance mosquitoes by any means, but they are often ones that are associated with human disease. And so you can reduce that. But again, if you oversimplify it and say, tell people, well, if you drain your bird bath every couple of days, you're not going to have mosquitoes. As I said, we find, like in Madison, our mosquitoes can be coming from spring green under the right conditions. So,
Chuck, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Kathy in North Fond du Lac, what's on your mind?
I've got the most bizarre thing going on. I planted a metal blazing star for the monarchs, which they love, and the bumblebees like it too. Well, I was just sitting on my little bench observing the monarchs, and then a bumblebee landed, and then this bee that looked like a honeybee size was like hovering about 6 inches away from the bumblebee, just like a fighter pilot. And then all of a sudden, he'd ram into the bumblebee trying to knock him off the flower. It was the craziest thing I ever saw. What kind of bee would that be? And well, he tries to knock the monarchs off, too.
Yeah, I'm guessing that they are something that look like a bee that are not. Your description sounds like there's a group of critters we call robber flies. And not all of them are bee mimics, but a couple of them are such a dead ringer for a bumblebee that unless, you know, I've got them close and stopped under a microscope, I don't pick it up. But they're predators. And so they eat insects and relatively big insects. And so I just wonder if you had a robber fly that was messing with everything there.
There you go. Still fun to watch, though, and interesting to watch, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Louise in Dodgeville, what's on your mind?
Hi. I am a fan of katydids. And I was just remarking to my husband, like, oh, I haven't seen any recently. But then I used the Seek app, and I saw a short-winged meadow katydid and an oblong-winged katydid just recently. So do they tend to come out around this time of year? And I guess I'm just curious about katydids. How many do we have in Wisconsin?
Yeah, boy, number of species, I'm taking a wild guess at that. I wouldn't be surprised if we're about 8 to 10 at least, and it could be more than that. Katydids work like grasshoppers in that most of those species overwinter as eggs, hatch in the spring, and the little critters are really kind of innocuous and you can't, you know, small enough and don't pay any attention. They mature in the middle to late summer. That's when they get wings, so they can become much more mobile, and that's when most people run into them. Now, most katydids are associated, you know, some people call them bush crickets. To an entomologist, they belong to a group that we call longhorn grasshoppers because they have very long antennae versus the grasshoppers you think of out in fields and the like have, we call shorthorn grasshoppers, and they have short antennae. But they're really very close relatives in the way they work. You know, most katydids are that green color, so they're camouflaged quite well. But, you know, if you're expecting them, it's going to be a mid to late summer critter, more active at night at times, you know, and so sometimes they're attracted to night lights and people will see them on the screens that way. In fact, that probably is where I have more luck finding them than anywhere else.
Louise, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, talking insects with him. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk with Paul Frater at the DNR about how to get involved in a statewide wildlife survey. I think there are three of them going on right now. And then at 12:30, we'll talk to Patrick Bolin, who's the new director of the UW Arboretum. Right now, it's the World of Insects with Phil Pelletieri. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. And let's take a call from Mary in Lebanon. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I'm calling because I want a recommendation of a good book to identify especially butterflies that I will see in Wisconsin. I have so many smaller ones around. I even have a little blue one, too, at times. Lots of little orange ones.
Have you looked at the Butterflies of Wisconsin site on the Internet?
I've not a whole lot, but I just thought...
Sure. I mean, the only reason I bring it up is I mean, there are some old books that I'm not even sure are in publication of butterflies of specifically Wisconsin. There's some of Minnesota. I think my colleague Jeff Hahn had written one. But Mike Reese, who supports that site, what I like about it is it's got all the butterflies, and it puts it in perspective for things that are common, not common, where they're found, and then people will report on a regular basis that they saw, let's say, their first monarch in Dodge County on the 15th of May. So there are reports around local, and it was interesting. I had a brother-in-law who saw a rather unique greenish-yellow butterfly, but he went to the Internet and wasn't the Wisconsin site, so he got something that I knew it was not right. I put him onto that site, and he picked it up, and it still was an unusual find. It was a southern critter that blows up here, and it was honestly the first record in quite some time that we had. Unfortunately, he didn't catch it or take a picture, so it's not an official record, but I believe him. But I, as I said, that would be the one site I think that I find is there's a number of pictures of each butterfly, and if there's distinguishing characters that help you separate from something that looks quite close, Mike has done a good job of putting those together. And so, as I said, I really like that site. I don't think there's anything I would find as comparable that is Wisconsin-specific.
Is there – could you repeat that website again?
Well, I think if you just do a search for Butterflies of Wisconsin, in fact, Mike does tiger beetles on his site, too, and he also does robber flies, what we were talking about earlier. And what's interesting is Mike takes lots of those pictures. I don't know anything more difficult than taking pictures of robin flies and robber flies in nature, but Mike does it. So he, aside from being a good biologist, he's a heck of a photographer.
There's one, if Mary wants something in her hands, there is a folding pocket guide to, it's titled Wisconsin Butterflies and Pollinators, a folding pocket guide to familiar species. And it's gotten good reviews. I don't personally have it, but I would, if it's something you want to have in your hands, Mary, it's Wisconsin Butterflies and Pollinators, a folding pocket guide. You could try that out and see how that would work too. But the website sounds fantastic, to be honest.
There used to be a publication from the Milwaukee Public Museum on Wisconsin butterflies, but it's quite dated. I mean, I was early in my career when that came out, and the pictures weren't in color and stuff. So, you know, it's a very useful thing, and the same thing, it would give you some kind of historic references and where to find them in the state, you know, and the like. And as I said, I at times you can be misled on the Internet, but when you find something specific for a state like this, usually it gets you in the ballpark. And as I said, even the odd things Mike's got on there, but if you find something that's not on there, you got something pretty special.
Yeah. Mary, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate it. Judy in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Thank you very much. We have a ground nest of yellow jackets that are under a rug juniper that we are concerned about, the juniper. Can we use the ortho spray that has tetramethrin and sumethrin, or are they likely to damage the roots of the juniper?
No, they will not hurt it. I've become particularly frustrated the general rule I use. First of all, where is the nest? Is there a lot of activity? If you're going to go by it with a lawnmower, you got to treat it. If it's in a place where there's not a lot of activity, they will eventually die out. The trouble with ground nests is we know where they're coming and going, but there is a paper wasp nest somewhere in the ground there. And if it's close by, you can get them quite easily. Sometimes even some of these foaming sprays you've got will work. But generally, I find ground nests are much more difficult. And my old standby is to tell people to use a dust-type product instead of a spray, because the dust works in a way that when they come and go, they pick it up. And the standard dust for most of my career was something we know as Carbaryl. It was sold under the name 7. So we had a wasp nest this spring. My wife got stung, so I went to the hardware store. I picked up 7. I applied the stuff. Was very disappointed in the response, and I go and look under the active ingredient. It's not even the active ingredient that I worked with my whole career. They've changed the product in there. 7 is a commercial name. This is an old insecticide that is not under patent anymore, so I'm sure they can't make money selling it. But my frustration is that the substitute products I don't think work as well. But you can try your spray. I would say either right away in the morning or in the evening, just about when it's dark, is the best time to treat it. But be careful for those ground nests, as I said, because I find with liquids in particular, the performance doesn't work. When you pour liquids, it's going into the ground. It's not staying on the surface to come into contact with stuff. And as I said, if the hole is designed in a way, because they're using old rodent burrows and chipmunk holes and the like, the nest could be 10 inches away from the opening, and the spray goes straight down on the ground and never gets to them. Whereas I said, the dust is kind of more of a forcing. And sometimes you find you can treat and, plug it with dirt or whatever right away, and that will take care of things.
Good luck, Judy. Thank you for calling. Tom in Madison, on to you now. Thank you for calling, Tom.
Hi. I'm referring to the mosquito discussion you had a little earlier. And something years ago I found with an interest in protecting myself from tick diseases out in the woods, and I go out and tromp around and take pictures, is the permethrin clothing. And I have a whole wardrobe of long nylon pants, permethrin socks, a permethrin camel hat, and a hooded nylon windbreaker that's impregnated with permethrin. You now can buy permethrin and make your clothes permethrin. It takes 70 washings to wash the permethrin out, and rather than kill the mosquitoes, I wear that garb when I work outside, and I don't have any mosquito bites. It's a great way to save the environment and save your hide.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you called. I have permethrin treated shirts. The archery club I belong to is in a swamp, and so when it gets wet, it gets atrocious. And the same thing, I put on my long sleeve shirts, and you can get some that are still light enough fabric that they're very breathable for the summer. And as you said, the added benefit is they work against ticks. And there are treatments you can buy to treat regular clothing. They don't last as long as the clothing where it's impregnated. It's interesting that technology was partially developed up at Camp McCoy in Wisconsin, because I remember early in my career when we were worrying about Lyme disease and the like, the Army was doing some of that work, and that's where the impregnated clothing first came out from. And now, of course, you can get it at L.L. Bean's and REI's and other outdoor things. And, yeah, I think it's well worth to have available for people, especially, again, if you're an outdoor person. It's not practical to go out in the woods and fog it and expect that to solve anything, versus, again, putting on the personal protection. And you don't have to put it on your skin, so you're not absorbing it and the like. So I do think that's a good direction to go.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tom. Appreciate it very much. Mary in Waupaca, what's on your mind?
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Every fall and winter, we get inundated with Asian beetles and stink bugs in our house to the point that it creeps you out. And I am wondering if what you would suggest for preventing that, and especially interested in a biodegradable solution that doesn't hurt the environment or other insects like bees, pollinators.
Sure. So, you know, the easy thing for me to say is that there are structural weaknesses in the house that these little critters are squeezing through. And if you could solve the riddle of how they're getting in, of plugging and checking soffits and the screening on your attic vents and all that other stuff, you can make a big difference. But I realize in older houses, there's just way too many things. So then the other option is there are treatments, and it's the time of year where we're talking early September to first week of October, depending which one of these fall invaders is what you go after. And whether you hire a commercial service or buy these products yourself, they're all pyrethroid insecticides. Pyrethroids have their pluses and minuses. But when you apply them on the sides of the house, and there are special formulations that honestly hold up better, you really don't have a lot of bee exposure and the like. It's different than if you went out and sprayed your flower garden. You'd say, boy, that's really not going to be good for the bees. But putting these products on the siding of the house, and for most of these critters, the upper part of the house, the overhangs, the soffits, the upper part of the siding is more important than worrying about the ground level. Now, there are precautions. These things aren't not good to get into water. So if your house was right next to a lake, that would probably, you'd have to think twice how you would apply it or like, because you don't want the product. But once it dries, it's not going anywhere. And so if they become enough of a frustration, as I said, you can talk to a professional pest control service, especially, you know, if you got a three-story house that you could not get to, then sometimes you need professional help. But the products that they're using, you can buy both at the hardware store or, honestly, the formulations that seem to be the best are often micro-encapsulated or enhanced in a way so they stick better to the siding. And some of those products are available on the Internet and the like. You know, there's you do your own pest controls and other things that will sell you similar products, if not the same products that the pest control services use. It's just kind of a matter of your own convenience and what you're comfortable with and the like. So, but you're definitely at the point of making that decision, I would think, within the next 3 weeks or so. I would not go much past the middle of September to stop fall invading critters. Little hard to call how they're going to be. You never really quite know. The Asian lady beetles don't start coming in until the first hard freeze, it seems. So that could be any time from early September to 1st of November. I think box elder bugs are going to be in low numbers this year just because there's a natural fungus disease that is very prevalent when it's wet, and it's definitely been wet enough that I am having a feeling that their populations are naturally knocked down. In stink bugs, it's a little early to call. I have not seen much Asian stink bug activity in my yard, but you know, the one thing with not working in the lab anymore, I don't have quite the perspective that PJ does of getting people calling in from around the state. So.
Yeah, yeah. Mary, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Tim in Menominee, Michigan. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Larry. Just want to say thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate your show and all your guests. My question today is about, it's a black wasp, and it seems like they make mud nests on walls and stuff, and I just don't know, is it a wasp? And what it is I'm looking at. They don't seem very aggressive.
Yeah, I think you've got mud daubers.
Yeah.
And they're more than one kind of mud dauber, and they are predators in the sense that they construct the nest. They put spiders or crickets, it depends what kind of mud dauber stuff we've got, lay their egg, and then they don't protect it. So this is technically, to an entomologist, a solitary wasp. Because even though you can have two or three of them in the area very close to each other, it's not a colony where we've got a queen and workers and those kind of things. And as I said early in the show, solitary wasps and bees tend to be very non-aggressive because there's really nothing to defend. Now, one of the dilemmas is even after they go next spring when the new adults come out and leave, you still got that cluster of mud sitting there. So there is a little bit of an eyesore there that, you know, some people would rather get off, and you know have to kind of almost scrape it with a putty knife or something.
Yeah. Tim, thank you very much for calling. Todd in La Crosse, what's on your mind?
Yes. Hello. Thank you. We have kind of for the first time had a lot of ants come in our house. It's a 19-year-old house and just haven't had a problem. But now this year they come through under the baseboard in our living room. We've been vacuuming them up many times a day. But what would you recommend, and ideally without a lot of poison?
Sure.
So the first question, wings on some of these ants or never wings?
They're kind of small, but then this last batch had a lot of wings.
Okay.
A little bigger with a lot of wings. They're not a giant carpenter ant, I don't.
Yeah, I think my first guess is pavement ant, and that is a guess because, you know, there are a number of ants. But what I was fishing for here, wing forms are the males and female queens and kings, if you want to think of them that way. They come out when you're close to the nest. They're nesting in the house. And, you know, not the end of the world, but it's different if we had ants just coming in the kitchen and we know the nests are outside, because what we preach is find the nest and treat it. Now, a couple things. If you knew exactly where they were coming out from a particular corner by the window, honestly, getting a spray. And what I would look for is something that has one of those little red applicator straws, like on a WD-40 can, so that you're pin streaming the spray into the wall void where the nest is. And just a couple squirts would solve the problem. If you don't know where the nest is, it's a little bit of shooting in the dark. It gets frustrating, and although there are ways of dealing with it, the other way of getting after ants is to bait them. And many of the baits have relatively non-toxic products. In fact, a lot of the baits on the market have boric acid, or in some cases they have some other types of insecticides. The dilemma is to find a bait they want. There are some ants that feed on sweets. There are some ants that feed on fats. And then honestly, there's a couple of ants that don't feed on either, which baits don't work very well. The frustration with the bait is you have to keep giving it to them for as long as they will take it. What I find is sometimes people will give it for a couple of days and then they give up on it, and that's not enough, because the concept is they pick up the product, they take it back and feed each other's, but most importantly, they feed the queen, which is the reproductive member of the colony. So I think you've got a couple options. You can look for these, as they said, if you can figure what they like. And what I would suggest is just take some wax paper and put a little bit of oil on it and a little bit of honey. So we got both the fat and we got the sweet, and see which of the two they like, and then buy the appropriate bait. Or as I said, if you can kind of pinpoint it physically, I think you can get away with a very small amount of any ant spray, but you've got to put it in the right spot, and it's basically, in this case, I think, to get it in the walls where they've been active.
Todd, good luck. Appreciate your call. Annie in La Crosse, we turn to you now. Thanks for calling, Annie.
Hi. I have a little gazebo in the backyard with mosquito netting, and of course it doesn't really block everything. And over the past several years, I've noticed that, dragonflies and other big flies and mosquitoes do get in there. But this year, there's nothing. And I have noticed that I haven't seen any dragonflies. I've seen the little things that look like dragonflies, but they're much, much smaller, but just a few of those. But I'm just wondering what's going on with the dragonflies and why there aren't as many insects.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because I didn't think about it, but I have not seen many dragonflies around, and this would have been a wet enough year that I don't see any. You can't blame it on a drought, because it's definitely not drought. I'm not sure. Now, again, it gets complicated because we've got dozens of species of dragonflies. The little critters you refer to are damselflies, which are related but are not predators like the adult dragonflies. I don't know what the dynamic is locally, but I said I've noticed the same thing, because in our garden usually we've got a couple dragonflies sitting around on the rocks waiting for something to come by, and I don't remember seeing that this year, which is odd.
Yeah. Annie, I'm sorry we can't give you more there. Thank you for calling. Mark in Osceola, on to you. Hi, Mark.
Got an observation on the box elder bugs. I use the rat size stick'em traps, put it right by the front door, inside and outside. The box elder bugs, there must be some pherone, or whatever they call it, to attract the mice and other rats. But the box elder bugs go to it. They get stuck in it. Had an observation. south wall of my garage. The sidewalk runs right along it. I have my pots along there, and the box elder bugs are on that side, and I have zero Japanese beetles. 4 feet away on the other side of the sidewalk, I have also have pots with roses and flowers loaded with Japanese beetles. Move the pot over to the south wall where the box elders are, and all the Japanese beetles leave.
That's strange.
Yeah, it's interesting. Your observation of you know, where the box elder bugs cluster and going after them, that is just spot on and the like. And using glue boards, I was talking to PJ yesterday because I usually check in with him, and he was giving me an interesting example of using glue boards to deal with a wasp nest that was in a firewood pile he had. And he didn't want to spray the firewood because, of course, they're going to burn it for, you know, when they're camping and the like. And so he would put these glue boards in where the wasps were coming and going. He'd say he'd catch a couple hundred wasps a day. After filling 3 or 4 glue boards, the problem was solved. So there are some uses. I am perplexed about the Japanese beetle. You know, I don't know if the light conditions during the day are different enough, you know, because Japanese beetles like to attack things out in the sun, things in the shade less likely. So I'm a little perplexed with that. I don't know of any repellent type product, you know, the geranium oil, and there's a couple things that are out there that have some repellency, but I couldn't believe it would be strong enough, even if it had the right stuff, to prevent them from going on your plants. I'm glad you brought Japanese beetle up, because, you know, I remember 20 years ago, they were so bad in my yard that I never saw a yellow flower on my potentilla. I mean, I'd go out there and with my soapy water and catch hundreds a day, and it didn't make a difference. I was sharing with PJ yesterday, I caught a total of 25 Japanese beetles all summer long in my yard, and I looked hard for them. And so what I've often told people is, you know, when they first get around, they can be absolutely devastating and to the point like a science fiction movie. But over time, it's been my experience that their numbers go, and to the point now, I don't think it's 0.1% of the population it was 20 years ago, which to me is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, I've had the same experience at my home as well. You just don't see them. It's interesting. Mark, again, thank you for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, to answer your insect questions. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow on the show, our book club talks about the book The Business Trip. It is a dandy novel by Jesse Garcia. And then we'll talk about ADHD with adults with Dr. Jake Behrens. That's tomorrow. Right now, though, insects with Phil. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Elaine in Madison emailed to ask for information about soldier beetles, which they recently found on their garden flowers. Soldier beetles.
Soldier beetles are a soft wing beetle. They are orange with some black markings on the wing. They love to feed on pollen, but they don't hurt anything. They're a late summer critter, and they're everywhere. I remember my grandson, when he was smaller, he used to come over, and we had a game of how many soldier beetles he could count, and we were often in the low hundreds. So it's common, but as I said, other than you could argue, well, they're kind of pollen stealers from other critters, but I think there's enough pollen to go around. So they're more of a curiosity. And as I said, most people think of beetles being crunchy. Well, this is like fireflies from a family where they're what we would call soft-winged beetles.
Brian in Two Rivers emailed to say they have a terrible problem with fruit flies in their small apartment. Brian says they've been told that the flies are coming up the drain in the sink. Is this accurate, and what can be done about them?
Okay, so when they're coming out of the drains and sink, probably not, but there is something called a drain fly, and there's another critter called a forage fly, which are more common. Forage flies are sewer flies, and it isn't that unusual to get debris caking along the pipe, and that's the kind of gunk that these things could breed in. So, you know, if there's ways they can flush that, they even make chemicals for cleaning drains, that would be something to consider. But, it, you know, fruit flies basically get on stuff that's not near as decayed as the stuff that's in the drain and sewers. Fruit flies breed on things that are overly ripe. And the secret to fruit flies is that their maggots feed on the yeast associated with decay and fermenting, whereas they said these sewer flies, it's farther along, but they're about the same size. You know, and that's why when people call with a small fly problem, usually we need to see a picture and the like to go after it. In fact, somebody had sent, the crew had sent me a picture that came in from somebody that said they're seeing critters in every room of the house, and it turns out that they have what appears to be a drain fly. And same kind of thing is you look at basement floor drains, which often don't get enough water to really flush them through. You look at bathroom sink drains because there's often debris that accumulates there. And the secret is to get that stuff cleaned out. If there's no food source, you've stopped the breeding and you're done.
Cindy emailed to ask for help identifying a caterpillar. It's a little over 2 inches long. It's all deep gray to black. No bristles, so smooth. It has a barb like a tomato hornworm at one end and a shiny black spot on the top of the head. A couple inches long, over 2 inches.
Yeah, when it's getting in that size, that leans towards the hornworms, and there are a number of different species, and some of the hornworms come in more than one color. So I can say that. In fact, there are some of the hornworms that don't even have the black spine, but they have an eye spot on the posterior end, which kind of throws people. So without seeing a picture, that would be the direction I would go. And again, I wonder if you get on the internet and go through hornworms and see if you can find a picture that would match up. You know, we really don't have any hornworms. And the tomato hornworm we talked about earlier is probably the only one that is really problematic in most cases, and even that's relatively minor. Most of them are more curiosities, and they transform into something we call sphinx moths, or hawk moths, or some people will even call them hummingbird moths, because some of them are as big as hummingbirds, and are really pretty neat critters.
Jim in Park Falls emailed to say they just returned from a canoe trip. They sent a photo.
Yes.
Canoe trip in the Turtle River Provincial Park near Ignace, Ontario, and attached a photo wondering what it was.
Yeah, so he's very observant because he thought maybe it was a type of deer fly, and we're, the size is that of a deer fly. And most deer flies have markings on the wings. Either they're black or they're striped and the like, and this critter has it. But when I look at it, it's kind of a bright yellow body, and it's fuzzy, which deer flies and horse flies aren't fuzzy. This comes from a group we would call a bee fly in Bombylids. It's a whole group, and again, they are very bee mimic-like if you really look at them close enough. I'm not particularly familiar with this particular species that he's got, but it is definitely a type of bee fly. And as I said, because of the size of the wing markings, I can see where he would suspect that it was a deer fly of some sort right away.
Linda in the Adams Friendship area has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I wonder, we were discussing one night when we were having a cookout why we felt there was less mosquitoes. Again, we brought up like the dragonfly populations. And we were wondering if it wasn't air quality from the fires and the smoke coming down.
Hmm.
Boy, interesting question. I'm guessing not, but it's a guess because I don't know of a lot of people that have experimented with that. And as I said, mosquitoes, when we see a community that has a mosquito problem, we honestly have to capture the mosquitoes, see what kind of biology they have and where they might be debris to start pointing fingers. And different things happen. There are years that it gets wet enough, often enough, and we get enough flooding that the mosquito numbers, instead of going up, go down, because what you do is you keep out flooding these temporary sites that are the biggest source of our mosquito problem. And so weird things happen. Even though there's a wet year, it doesn't mean it's got to be bad. There are all kinds of things that feed on mosquitoes, and dragonflies are definitely one of the big heroes that are there. But as I said, usually the dynamic is more complicated. And I just wonder, again, this year, if I had to take a guess, you might have the kind of mosquitoes where they were breeding that it's been just flushing them down the river, if you would think of it that way. So,
Jan in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hello. Yeah, just have a quick question. A week or so ago, I had some bare ground in front by my door and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, I saw these fairly big wasps, and they were all digging separate little holes. They're kind of gloss. They're fairly big. They're kind of glossy, kind of a greenish, blackish and stuff. And they're all digging separate holes and going in. And I kind of messed with them just to see if they were aggressive a little bit with the hole and with a hole and stuff. And they don't seem to be aggressive, but I was just kind of curious what they might be and if they're like a pollinator or something.
Yeah, no, so it's one of two things in your description. In things digging, I've got the big cicada killers in my yard, which look like the biggest yellow jacket you've ever seen. And they dig holes in the ground. They go and parasitize a cicada, put it down in the hole, lay their egg, and go. This, I think, is from a critter that's either going to be cricket hunters or another one of the predators. So, again, they're creating that chamber. They're provisioning it with whatever their food source preference is. And, you know, some of these things, as I said, just feed on crickets. Other ones feed on grasshoppers. It's really kind of interesting. And then they lay their egg there, but they have nothing to do with caring for their young. Their young will develop in the ground by themselves. So, again, by our definition, they are solitary wasps. And as I said, that just makes them a much calmer critter. Not saying that if one flew down your shirt, you wouldn't get stung. They are capable of stinging, but it's not in their nature to be aggressive, even if you're messing with the provisions that they're putting in those little holes and the like.
Okay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. So you can leave them be. Christy in Chippewa County, hi.
Hi. This week, on a nice little dogwood, pagoda dogwood that was a gift from a friend, there were leaves being devoured, and underneath there were a bunch of curled up dogwood sawflies identified by Seek. I cut the leaves off. Didn't want to use any pesticides. Seek says they're native. What would you recommend?
Okay. So dogwood sawfly, typically sawflies come in herds. I mean, they feed in colonies, and this is one of them. One of the things is mark your calendar, because they are relatively predictable as far as their seasonal activity, and I think of them as kind of a late summer critter. They're small enough that, honestly, a soapy water spray would be potentially. There are some organic products. Spinosad is an organic product that is somewhat selective in what it would kill. So if you wanted to go that direction, but again, I think of this year, they may be done, you know, and so it's not worth really going after them. But next year, if you can make a garden calendar and say, you know, about 2 weeks from earlier, just go out and start to see if you can see that first few little nicks of feeding. And at that case, as I said, definitely the soapy waters work better on smaller critters than bigger critters. And you can basically solve the problem before it gets out of hand. The one thing about insects feeding on plants is plants can tolerate easily 30 to 40% leaf loss without really affecting their health. Now, new transplants, you know, you want to give them every advantages you can. But sometimes I think people overreact. Where we get most concerned about insects that totally strip leaves, if they do it early enough in the season that the plant has to re-leaf, that often grossly weakens the plant. A lot of this fall feeding that goes on really is really more cosmetic, because, as I said, the plant has gotten most of the benefits of the leaves during the summer, and it's not going to re-leaf, and so it's not going to get near as weakened as you might think.
Yeah. Christy, there you go. Thank you so much. And Phil, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we can do this again in a month or two. Thank you, Phil.
Take care.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. It's great to have him back, and he will be back, and we'll do it again. Coming up next, a visit from Paul Frader of the DNR. We'll talk about some wildlife surveys you can get involved in. I'm Larry Mueller.